still had plenty of fans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to an action-packed Juno afternoon on this Friday afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. I'm your host for today, and today we're going to be talking to Odin Brody about Saturday's legislative loop ski race. Dana Herden will be here to highlight the upcoming Innovation Summit. We're going to get a preview of the Friday fireside lecture about an experimental forest. Sarah Schaefer will be here to highlight Saturday's seafood festival, and we're going to be talking to Mary Ellison and Shona Osterhout about home, but not homeless. That's a play built on Alaskan voices. That's all coming up, plus Writer's Almanac and all kinds of fun stuff, music, surprises. You don't know. None of us know. But first, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes in Montana are proposing to build a pedestrian trail along historic travel paths, as Nikki Ouellette of Montana Public Radio reports.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes are seeking federal funding for a 34-mile stretch along an existing highway right-of-way. At a community meeting at the Tribal Council office on Wednesday, project manager Casey Ryan ticked off the benefits of the proposed trail.
It would increase transportation safety for all residents here on the Flathead Reservation. It would also provide economic ladders for success for people who have compromised access to motor vehicles. It would make local transportation more environmentally sustainable.
Ryan added the trail would connect communities on the reservation and provide safe passage for an annual walk the Salish people make from their current reservation to ancestral lands, a three-day journey to commemorate their forest removal in the late 1800s. The tribes are seeking $38 million in funding from the Federal Department of Transportation. DOT denied their so-called Tiger Grant application last year, but project supporters are hopeful increased community support, along with breaking the project into five independent segments, will make them successful this time around. I'm Nikki Ouellette.
Leaders of the Tohono O'odham Nation in Arizona are inviting President Donald Trump to visit them and discuss border issues after Trump signed an executive order this week on border security and immigration enforcement. A press statement by the Tohono O'odham chairman and vice chair states the tribe was not consulted. The tribe's reservation includes 75 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border with tribal members on both sides. While the leaders do not support a border wall, which Trump insists will be built, they say the tribe will continue to do its part to ensure border security and work with federal agencies. The Navajo Nation and the federal government have reached a legal settlement to clean up abandoned uranium mines on the reservation. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
The settlement addresses about 20% of the more than 500 abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Justice Department, and the tribe reached the deal with two subsidiaries of the mining company Freeport-McMoRan. The federal government will pick up about half the cost. The public will have 30 days to comment on the settlement. If it's finalized, it'll bring the total number of mines set for remediation to more than 200. Uranium was mined on the 27,000-square-mile Navajo Nation for more than four decades until the late 1980s. The tribe banned processing and mining the radioactive metal on its land in 2005. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A Lakota filmmaker from the Pine Ridge Reservation is attending the Sundance Film Festival, taking place in Park City, Utah. Jim Kent has more.
Willie White's interest in films goes back to his elementary years at the Red Cloud School.
I was in the seventh grade. I was about 12. And that was at the time the first Lord of the Rings film came out, and I remember just being so captivated by the whole thing and wanting to do that and wanting to be a part of that in any way.
Willie held on to his dream through high school and into college, where his first film experience was in music videos. He's worked on three feature films over recent years and will now be using the $20,000 Sundance Fellowship to help produce his first short film, Mie Ukie, or You, Me, I.
The story is based off a teaching, one of our traditional stories about the different spirits in creation, and it's all about this idea of balance that we need to find and have in order to have true happiness.
Attending the Sundance Festival will help the young director to network with other filmmakers. Staff of the Sundance Institute's Native Filmmaker Lab will assist Willie White in the production of Mie Ukiye, which is scheduled to be completed by October in order to be submitted for next year's festival. I'm Jim Cairns.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com. Support by VisionMaker Media, whose mission is to empower and engage Native people to tell stories. VisionMaker Media is currently pleased to offer public media internships. You can find out more at VisionMakerMedia.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
In 1977, John McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country, captured a pivotal moment in Alaska.
It is about what McPhee came to believe was the real Alaska. And part of the reason for this book's continuing popularity is that many Alaskans also feel that that's the real Alaska.
Alaska's Energy Desk is revisiting the book and its memorable characters 40 years later. Listen for the series on KTOO.
Monkeys there, continuing on the fresh air tip of what they were playing. Andy Klein with you for Juno Afternoon, and right now in the studio with me is Odin Brody. Odin, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, Andy.
We're going to talk legislative loop ski race, and that's done by the Juno Nordic Ski Team. We got two members of the ski team here, Sage and Finn. Thanks you guys for coming in. How you guys doing?
Good.
What's it's a pretty good year for snow, right?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Pretty
Eagle Crest. Yeah, right. Been having a good time. So tell me, Odin, about this race specifically, and then it's part of a series, right?
Yeah, well, we of the Juno Nordic Ski Team, which is a group including Finn and Sage, I'm happy to have here with me. We practice as a team 4 days a week, and hey, we got to have some races.
Yeah,
some of the kids have gone out of town for a race, but so we have a community series, and we had a New Year's Eve resolution race, and this is in honor of the season and the session. Tomorrow's race at 11 o'clock at Eagle Crest at the lower loop is the legislative loops with a couple distance options. But it's a skate ski race.
Okay, so are you guys both skate skiers?
We skate ski and classic.
Ski.
Yeah.
And so the races are sort of divided into the two types, right?
Yeah.
Because if they didn't, then skate skiers would win every time.
Yeah.
And that's what actually happened when skate skiing was kind of invented, right? All of a sudden, there were a couple of guys out skate skiing, and they just lapped everyone, right?
Yeah, like Bill Koch.
Oh, okay. Is that the, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
The American guy.
Yeah.
And that was back in the 80s. It was obviously a different sport.
Yeah, it was like when the first catamaran entered the America's Cup or something. And all of a sudden, this new technology happened, and it was completely blew everyone else out of the water. So long, I'll start with you, how long have you been skiing?
This is my second year on the ski team.
Okay. So. But have you been kind of Nordic skiing for a long time, or is that when you picked it up?
I kind of knew how to before, but I hadn't really practiced, and I didn't have my own skis or gear for Nordic skiing yet.
Right. So. How about you, Finn?
I have been doing it for 3 years. So.
Okay.
And I haven't. I just started 3 years ago.
Had you like snowboarded or downhill skied before that?
Yeah, I downhill skied before that, but not any Nordic skiing.
Yeah, right. So what about it? Kind of, what do you like about it?
What I like about Nordic skiing is that I feel like there's more exercise through it than downhill skiing.
Yeah, you gotta be in shape.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. Okay, like your lungs will burn, man.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how long is the race, this race that's coming up? There's a couple of distance options, right?
Tomorrow the options are you can go roughly 5 kilometers, 7.5 kilometers, or 10 kilometers. And it's all skate ski race. And the reason why we're sponsoring the community race series is The skiers are in good shape, so every 2 weeks we hold a race, but we open it up to the community. Anybody who wants to come, there's not a registration fee. When we race at Eagle Crest, we ask people to get a trail pass at the lodge. We meet in the lower meadows of the lower loop at Eagle Crest, and the race starts at 11.
Does the ski team start first? So you don't get bogged down by these community members getting in your way, or how does that work?
Generally, we all jump in together.
Yeah.
Does that work for you guys?
Just go.
And you just know you're going to start lapping people pretty soon, right?
Yeah, right.
You guys are training, man.
Yep.
And you got Coach Broody on you all the time, barking at you. Move it. Go. What's it like to coach?
Oh, it's
Nordic
fun.
Ski team? How is that as a coaching exercise?
It's easy and enjoyable. You have generally young skiers are motivated to be there, and you're pushing them a little, and you're helping with technique. And
it seems like that's the thing, right? Like technique, right? It's just like really learning, really figuring out all that stuff.
Yeah.
And which one do you find harder, classic or skate ski?
For me, I think skate skiing is a little harder because you gotta really get that flat ski.
Yeah.
On the,
what do you mean by that?
Like, you don't want to be on your edges.
Oh, but you're pushing with an edge.
Yeah, but you want
to
be.
But leading ski has to be flat.
Yeah, and then
How about you? Do you think?
I think skate skiing is more complicated. There's a lot more.
A little more movement, stuff. A little bit more coordination kind of stuff. You can't get away with a missed. You kind
of
can't get away with a missed stroke in a way, right?
People.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can pick up.
Yeah, because you can end up with a yard sale real quick.
And you can use a lot of energy skate skiing, too. But if you, with certain technique, you can get more bang for your buck for calories.
Well, so are you encouraging kind of all levels of people to come out for this? And
yes, that's why we have the shorter distances, and we probably have a distance that's even shorter than 5K. Some younger skiers are coming out too. So we'll generally have one mass start out in the meadow, and that kind of makes it more fun too.
And then part of the Juno Nordic ski team itself, who do you guys compete against? You go up against other ski team?
We're kind of the only Nordic ski team in Juneau, so we just compete against each other.
Oh, okay, you just kind of get out and compete against each other. Are there other? Do you ever have visiting cities, or you get to travel around a little bit, or anything like that happen?
There is the buckwheat that's in.
Buckwheat's up in Skagway.
Yeah, in Skagway.
I've done that.
Yeah.
I'm a classic. You can probably tell I'm a classic. Nordic skier.
The theme for that this year is Dr. Seuss.
So.
Oh, that's good.
So,
it's your theme.
Oh, that's good. A lot of thing ones and things twos out there, I'll bet. Yeah.
The Buckwheat Ski Class is the 25th of March.
All right, very cool. Yeah, so that's always a really fun
event. And a
lot
of our skiers.
Yeah.
Finn went up to Anchorage for a race in December.
Yeah, the Besh Cup in Anchorage. And that was really fun.
So how did you kind of measure up? I mean, that's kind of like the big city, right? Like there's
a lot of pretty serious
racers up there, right?
There.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you feel you did?
I felt I did pretty good.
We
learned
a lot and kind of like saw people who had real technique and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Yeah. You get hooked on it kind of, right?
That really was really cool.
So you're going to have a goal next year about, okay, I kind of did this. Now I'm going to next year maybe try to get
do
into
it. Do a little better.
Yeah, very cool. Well, that's great. Well, Sage and Finn, thanks so much for coming in, telling us about
this.
Awesome to meet you. And Odin, one more time for folks who want to get involved in tomorrow's race.
Tomorrow's race, the Legislative Loop, come on up. There's a parking lot before you get all the way to Eagle Crest on the left. We're calling it the Nordic Ski Club parking lot by the meadow, and people are going to park there and race at 11 o'clock. There's another race coming up on the 11th in a couple weeks in honor of Valentine's Day, the Sweetheart Relay. So watch for details on that one coming up in a couple weeks.
Very cool. It's the Legislative Loop Ski Race happening tomorrow. Juneau Nordic Ski Team sponsors it. Thanks so much for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back to a Juno Afternoon, and I'm joined by Mary Ellison and Shona Osterhout, who are here to talk a little bit about
home but not less.
It's a play built on Alaskan voices. This is how many years? Is this the second year you're doing this?
Or? Actually, this is an expansion of a play that we did 2 years ago.
Okay.
Just about the same weekend opening. Opening is tonight. So, yeah, Andy, it was. We had a good response, and we decided to expand with more voices. So I spent a fair bit of time really interviewing and talking to people here, as well as going to Anchorage and Fairbanks and more statewide meetings, youth meetings, and talking to a lot of different people who had been or were homeless, or whose lives and jobs intersected with issues around that.
So that's a fascinating project. Now, how you got involved? Are you directing it this time around?
Yes.
Okay.
So I directed the first one,
okay.
And then Mary said, hey, will you do that again? And I was like, well, I really don't have much going on. That's a joke. And so I was like, sure,
Shona's
I would love
here with
to
a
do
little,
that.
A little tyke, a little tiny baby in her arms, by the way, for those of you listening. You wouldn't know it because he's so wonderfully behaved. So
right now,
he's
going to
share his voice shortly.
Yes, good.
That's right.
Good.
So, we jumped right back in. And for those folks who are like, oh, well, I saw that last time, it's actually different. It's staged a lot differently. It has new voices. It's there's some concrete action items that people can get involved. And I know after the media assembly meeting this past week that it'd be, you know, people want to do things. So
it's amazing that it's such an amazing thing that when we talked 2 years ago, Mary, this was something that was on the front page. It was an issue we were grappling with. And here we are 2 years later. You're doing the play again. And it's just as vibrant an issue and just as important an issue to tackle as it's always been. So,
It's interesting. I've really worked hard to not think of that word issue, but because homelessness is a symptom of so many root causes, and I think that's what these stories sort of capture. One of my favorite lines was actually given by Dan Austin from St. Vincent de Paul. There are as many reasons to be homeless as there are people who are homeless. And I also think, like, I totally echo what you said, and I really struggle with that. Like, wow, now's the right time. I mean, that's sort of a sad, powerful coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really wasn't Shona saying, yeah, well, I do that. It was sort of a meeting of our minds and our hearts going, okay, we're not going to let this to rest. We're going to put one more attempt at expanding this and reaching more people and just really trying to work with and connect with and guide audiences to what's going on and what we can do about it and who's involved.
So let's talk about it a little bit. We kind of jumped in here, but this is different than a typical play people might see. It was a project where you're really trying to gather the firsthand accounts of many people. And you say, as this poster is saying, it's inspired by over 100 interviews with Alaskans. So tell me, as you're directing that, how are you trying to, what are you doing to interpret those voices?
Sure. Well, you know, it's hard because a lot of people know a lot of the voices because there's Juno, there's Anchorage voices, and so we know who these people are. So it's not that we're actually trying to replicate who these people are. Oh, and sometimes we definitely say we'll use an accent here for someone who has one or, you know, things like that. And but we're not trying to kind of mimic or copy. What we're trying to do is actually get the what is this person, and we use them as a character, what are they trying to say, and how do we get that across to the audience? So it's a little bit, you know, it's different that way, but they are true words. And also Mary has taken, you know, she spent hours with folks, mm-hmm. like an hour at a time, sometimes more. And so we're trying to boil, you know, she's boiled it down to what is kind of the meat
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are snippets and they're pieced together. So we've really worked hard, and Mary's worked her bum off to say, how do these actually work? You know, how do they flow?
Mm-hmm.
How does the story get told in a shorter amount of time? It's kind of like a slice. It's like if you would take a, it's like if Pat Race was going to edit a movie or something, he would say, what's the most important clip? And that's the part we're using.
But the thing that's really fascinating is that you're just really taking these multiple clips of people, but you're weaving them together in a way that is that narrates a flow of a story or tries to get at the larger
I believe it has a cumulative impact, and I mean, Shona's right, and I really have to say that when we dove back in, I was going back and forth between Anchorage and talking to people and go, this is a person who I met today. And then during this process, I would write a scene, and, you know, while we end up with, I don't know, however many monologues or scenes or vignettes are in the play, 20, I don't really know, but those were because I'd throw her 7, and she'd go, okay, this one, you know, and then I'd work on that, and then we'd figure out, what does this mean, and how do these events work together? How do these voices work together? And sometimes people will hear that's a pretty it's amazing to watch Shona and this cast and crew work, but sometimes it's 2 lines, and that represents, you know, 12 pages of my single spaced interview with somebody. But that's what it is, and that's what we've tried to create. So,
well, it's Home But Not Less, a play built on Alaskan voices. It's at McPeters Hall. Just tell the kind of. I'll just go through it here. It's starting
tonight.
Starting tonight. All right.
That's right. We had our first
preview
last night.
You did
it
as play as you can last night. So it starts tonight. Okay. So the first opportunity for people to see it, and then goes through Saturday and Sunday, and then repeats again next. Starts next Thursday and goes through the next 4 days there as well, right?
It goes through the 2 shows on the next Saturday, so we're not doing a Sunday matinee on Super Bowl Sunday.
Well, that's probably, yeah.
I've learned the hard way, Andy. Yeah.
So I also wanted to jump in and say that every show is followed by a dialogue with with leaders and resource people from our community, and those people, it's really amazing who've stepped forward, Mandy, from AWARE, Pastor Campbell from Northern Light, Rory Watt, our city manager, Representative Keto, Michelle Strickler of Family Promise, President Peterson of Tlingit-Haida Central Council. So we have a great lineup of, you know, 3 or 4 people after every show who will help us learn more how their jobs are involved in issues, as well as what people can do to help and what's going on. There's some really amazing things happening as well.
Awesome. Mary and Shona, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know. You guys are busy, I know. Gonna opening night tonight.
Yeah, we're excited.
Gonna run over to the theater.
Sleep in tomorrow.
I am running over to the theater.
I'm supposed to be with those kids ski racing, but I don't know if I'm going to make it.
I don't know about that. All right, it's happening at McPeters Hall tonight. 7:30 is the first show, 7:30 again tomorrow night, 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday, and then kind of repeating again starting on Thursday next weekend, going through Saturday with 2 shows on Saturday. It's Home But Not Less, and it's at McPeters Hall. And Mary and Shona, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
All right, coming up right now, here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 27th of January, 2017. It was on this day, 1302, the Italian poet Dante Alighieri was exiled from Florence for his political sympathies. He was a leading supporter of the White Guelph Party, which was opposed to extreme papal power. And when the Black Guelph Party seized power in Florence, they immediately expelled Dante from the city. He spent the next 2 decades wandering from place to place, in northern Italy, estranged from his wife and children. His only consolation was his writing. He wrote his great work, The Divine Comedy, about a journey through hell, purgatory, and paradise. It's the birthday of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, born in Salzburg, Austria, 1756, who only lived for 35 years. But he started early, child prodigy from a family of musicians, toured all over Europe, wrote his first opera at the age of 11. He died at the age of 35 in mysterious circumstances. There's a popular image of him dying poor, miserable, working on a funeral requiem as he died. But overall, his final year was a productive one. He was living in Vienna. He was still getting commissions. He didn't have a lot of money that year, but then again, he rarely did. He and his wife, Constanze, never seemed able to live on what Mozart made. It was a busy year. In the first months of 1791, he wrote dance music for the winter balls at the court. He wrote the Piano Concerto No. 27. In the summer, a messenger came asking Mozart to write a requiem for his patron, Count Franz von Walsig, who had lost his wife, wanted to commission a requiem in her honor. Mozart was working on the opera La Clemenza di Tito to celebrate the coronation of Emperor Leopold as King of Bohemia, which premiered in early September, and 3 weeks later, his opera, The Magic Flute, opened in Vienna, which was a big hit. In October, he wrote the Clarinet Concerto in A, then a cantata for the Freemason Lodge, which he directed himself, November the 18th. Finally, he put all his energy toward the Requiem, but just after the performance of the cantata, he became extremely ill. He had a fever, his whole body was swollen. He continued writing the Requiem right up until he died, which was only 2 weeks after he became sick. And he died on December the 5th, 1791, was buried in a mass unmarked grave, which was a common practice for the middle class of Vienna. Nobody knows what his illness was. There are many theories about it: rheumatic fever, tuberculosis, syphilis, congestive heart failure, kidney disease, poisoning. But today is his birthday, 1756. Mozart, who said music in even the most terrible situations must never offend the ear, but always remain a source of pleasure. Here's a poem by John Dryden, Happy the Man. Happy the man, and happy he alone, he who can call today his own, he who secure within can say, tomorrow do thy worst, for I have lived today. Be fair or foul, or rain or shine, the joys I have possessed in spite of fate are mine. Not heaven itself upon the past has power, but what has been, and I have had my hour. Happy the Man by John Dryden. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry, more at poetryfoundation.org, and by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for this program comes from the Prospector Hotel. The hotel is pet-friendly and features non-smoking accommodations, an on-site restaurant, and parking. Reservations at 586-3737 or prospectorhotel.com.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and from the Juno Economic Development Council, putting on the Innovation Summit, Dana Herndon is here. Dana,
thanks so much for
coming.
Me.
Absolutely. Innovation. The future.
Future is here. North to the future.
This has really turned into such an interesting and cool event that's happened every year that people just look forward to, and so many, you know, it's always kind of this thing now where the Innovation Summit happens, and then you kind of wait for a few months and go, okay, what came out of... what cool thing is going to happen now because of the Innovation Summit? So,
yeah, 6 years JDC has been doing this event. And every year there's something cool that comes out of it. I mean, some of our attendees will say, oh, I came up with this amazing idea from the Innovation Summit and all the content there. So Bob Verness and the electric whale watching boat is an idea that stemmed from there. We have a gentleman from Seafood Analytics who found his business partner from there. Brandon Howard was just telling me earlier from Amalga Distillery that he met a bunch of, you know, potential investors, and it was a great networking event. So we love putting it on because every year we innovate at the Innovation Summit.
Right.
I mean, the content changes, the kinds of things we have changes. So it's always something new there, but everyone can just expect a really great networking event, a lot of great ideas, and a lot of huge announcements. Last year, Juno Hydropower announced a district heat project there. We always have our partners at Sea Alaska and Haani always announce the Path to Prosperity winners. So it's really great. A lot of great information.
It's become this focal point for sort of business development and for idea development and you know, that happens in Juno. I should actually just say full disclosure, in my other role working at the brewery. I work at Alaskan Brewing, and Alaskan Brewing is one of the sponsors of the Innovation Summit. And also our founder, Jeff Larson, is going to be speaking at it. So just in the nature of full disclosure that I have been helping and getting involved in putting this together. But so tell me about the other speakers and what are some of the highlights that people can expect this year? Yeah.
So we do have three main summit speakers. So, like, as you mentioned, Jeff is one of them. We have a gentleman named Robert Tucker. He's the president of the Innovation Resource in California. He's coming up, and he talks about using innovation for maximum growth in your business. So about, enveloping innovation and all your processes and not have it just be an afterthought, which is going to be really cool. And then we have Angela Rodell, who's the CEO of Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and she's going to be talking about evaluating the investment of, like, some of these innovative business opportunities.
Which is such a key thing, right? You can get so caught up in a cool idea that you don't necessarily maybe do the due diligence on evaluation for, is it a sound investment or not?
Yeah, does it have legs?
Will it
make money?
Right.
You know, that's important.
Those are key to business.
It's super important.
Yeah,
and
right.
It's cool because some of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation team members, people that work there, they're going to be experts in our pitch contest. So they'll be like the panelists there that will be evaluating, you know, that investment opportunity and if it is one and if it makes a return on investment. So
that's
cool.
That's a really cool thing, too, where these young entrepreneurs who have these ideas get to pitch. And number one, it's great practice no matter what, right? You're developing your pitch. You know you're going to be in front of a bunch of professionals who've heard these kinds of ideas before and have had to evaluate business, and that's what they do for a living. And then they make the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a low-risk environment to make the pitch, right? Because in a way, it's just kind of an academic exercise, except that the person who's deemed to have the best pitch actually gets a sort of scholarship or sort of a seed money.
Well, we crowd-raise the money.
Yeah.
So we use the app Pool Everywhere, and some people will vote on that. Or you can buy a ticket for $10 to have, like, voting rights. And then all that will go into a pot of money.
And that's what they win.
And then we have sponsors too that will cushion that with more money. But they do come out with cash, and
it's
really
also
great.
Such a prestigious thing for a young entrepreneur, for a new entrepreneur, an entrepreneur with a new idea, to be able to say this idea was deemed the best at this Innovation Summit. You know, that's even if you don't come away with the starting amount of money you need. You've got a really good, substantial thing to talk about.
It's something, too. And it's something to just be able to go up in front of a crowd and talk about it and pitch the idea. It's like, you know, you can have a potential investor right there, even though you don't win.
Right,
you still can make that connection.
Sure.
So it's really great. It's our second year doing it. Last year was really well-received. It was new last year, and we were like, let's do it early, so like 7 a.m. early. And we filled the room. I mean, tons of people came.
That's
and
cool.
There was a lot of engagement. So we're definitely doing it again this year. And
so tell me how did the kind of the summit looks. It's a two-day summit, two-day kind of conference,
day
right?
Day and a half.
Okay.
Because we know people are taking time off work to come. So it's a day and a half. So on the first day, we have the welcome ceremony. We'll have the mayor come and speak, President Richardson or Peterson from Central Council.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have we have a creative portion too, so something that speaks to the arts and culture here in Alaska. We have innovation shorts, so that's kind of like a TED Talk where people from around Alaska and our community will come and talk about, attendees themselves will have the floor for 10 minutes and talk about something new and cool that they're working on, a new idea, a project, a process, something that's happening in their business. It's not like a sales pitch, but it's more like, you know, let me tell you about something cool I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really exciting. On the first day, we also have innovation tours. So the first half of the day, or a few hours in the day, we'll go to different places in Juneau. So you get to choose a tour you want to go on or not, but it's really fun.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
One is manufacturing, so we'll be going to the brewery. We'll be going to Heritage Coffee Roasting, the headquarters. We'll be going to Taku Smokeries. Or some people can go to the mine, Treadwell Mine, and the museum. So we have different things that people can choose from.
Just kind of demonstrating different industry that's happening,
yep.
Different businesses that are happening in town that have an innovative streak to them.
Definitely.
Yeah, right.
And also this year that's new, on the first day, we have the Alaska Innovators Hall of Fame induction ceremony, and it's exciting because there's going to be three individuals from Southeast, you have to come and see for yourself, that are going to be inducted and the Hall of Fame, and that's something that the Statewide Committee for Research does, and they evaluate. You know, it's like a lifetime achievement. So it's really exciting. So mm-hmm. that will be announced at the summit.
And so that's all day one?
That's all day one.
Then what happens on
day two? Day two is it's much more like interactive. So we are still working on this portion, but it's basically an interactive portion where you can, you kind of like rapid prototype a business idea and like take it from an idea to, can we actually come out of this room and see if this product works?
Well, that's cool.
You know, and then another
one. So a great exercise in just sort of developing ideas and what the different kind of steps along the way are.
Definitely.
Then maybe an actual cool idea could happen.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
We did that last year as an experiment, but this year people had fun. So we're going to do that, but we're evolving it a little bit to make it more like cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
And the second day you have the mini sessions with the three summit speakers. So Jeff Larson, Robert Tucker, and Angela, and it's more in-depth Q&A session with these speakers. We have receptions.
So how can people get involved? How can they sign up? How can they, you know, tell them?
All the major details.
All the deets.
So it's happening on February 15th and 16th at Centennial Hall. You can register at jedc.org/innovation. And more than register, you can get all the information there on what our agenda is going to look like, who's going to be there. We also have an app. So you can download the event-based app from the Apple Store or Google Play and get all the information there also. It's going down on February 15th and 16th. So, and you can register at jedc.org/innovation. It's definitely worth it.
JEDC with the Innovation Summit, jedc.org/innovation.
Yes, sir.
Dana Herndon, thanks so much for coming in. And
thanks,
let us know
Andy.
About it. Have
yes.
a great summit. If you don't, if I don't see you before that, have a great summit.
Yes.
All right. Welcome back. It's the Juno Afternoon on this Friday afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, and with me now in the studio is Rick Edwards. Rick Edwards is from the Pacific, Pacific Northwest
Well, I'm from the Forestry Sciences Lab here in Juno,
okay.
And we're with the Pacific Northwest Research.
And tell me, so you're going to do a Friday fireside lecture tonight out at the Mendenhall Visitor Center. You're doing two of them, actually, right? Usually the doors
That's
open
right.
around
yep.
6:30, something like that?
6:30, I think, is due to start.
Okay.
And then there's another one. I believe it's at 8.
Okay, terrific. And what I have here on this piece of paper is experimental forest.
That's correct.
What is an experimental forest? Let's talk about that.
All right. Well, that'll be part of the topic of tonight. The Forest Service and the Pacific Northwest Research Station is a branch of the Forest Service. It's the R&D branch. And the Forest Service has a network of 83 experimental forests and ranges throughout the United States and Puerto Rico. And the Hinchatini, which is the name of the one I'll be talking about tonight, is the latest in this network of experimental forests. An experimental forest is a land use designation, or LUD, where we are in the latest forest plan as our own LUD. And it's an area set aside on national forest land, with some exceptions, for the purpose of research, teaching, and demonstration.
So these are set aside of lands that maybe demonstrate certain specific aspects of the forest? Is that kind of the idea?
You can think of it as a sort of an agricultural experimental station. One of the functions of experimental forests is to demonstrate best practices, for example. And so a lot of the work that's going on in the lower 48 are experiments to determine the impact of different types of timber harvest, for example, on water, water quality, wood quality, and so forth. And so these things will also be areas where people can come and tour and see these practices on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The other function is research, and some of the research is in direct support of land management, and others is more theoretical or general to understand how watersheds and forests work, again, with the aid of the aim of informing management on those lands.
Is there something specific about the experimental forest you'll be talking about tonight that is demonstrated?
Well, there are some specific things about this particular experimental forest. Not all experimental forests are used for active land management experiments, and that applies to Hinchatini. This is more, some of the experimental forests actually are called hydrologic laboratories. They're for more general observation and call it passive experimentation, if you will, where we measure variables within the watershed designed to understand better how the watershed functions in its intact state.
So when the Forest Service looks at that, do you have to interact with other agencies as well to kind of get the full effect of certain practices? I'm thinking, for instance, what salmon counts might be in streams near places that have been harvested in certain ways, those kinds of things.
Absolutely. That's an easy sell in this part of the country. In other parts of the country, the answer is no. These watersheds are isolated in upper mountains in very large states, and they're a long way from anything else. But there has been a tendency to recognize the interaction of forested watersheds with surrounding landscapes and other actions. But in Alaska, of course, you really can't do any work that's generally applicable unless you consider linkages with other ecosystems. So although we don't necessarily work explicitly with colleagues from other agencies in the experimental forest, in fact, we do sometimes. We have given permission and support to Alaska Fish and Game to do a coho stock assessment on the land, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And we constantly interact with other colleagues to understand what the larger scale implications of our research are and vice versa.
Are there other things about Alaska forests or the Tongass National Forest in particular that are very different than other types of forests that are being studied?
You got it. We're right in the middle of what we call the perhumid coastal temperate rainforest. And part of my talk will fill in a little detail about what that actually means, what's distinct about that, what's similar to other forests, but those particular distinctive traits of a perhumid coastal temperate rainforest that require better understanding and also acknowledgement as we think about managing these landscapes.
Does it somehow make this forest more fragile, less fragile, more susceptible? Does it dictate different types of management?
You know, I'm uncomfortable with the term
fragile. Yeah,
I don't think there are any fragile ecosystems. Ecosystems change. And they're not fragile because they don't care if they turn into something else. We're the ones that care. Humans are the ones who are fragile. The ecosystem is very robust. Let's face it, this place we're sitting was under thousands of feet of ice only a mere 10,000 years or so ago. And so you can't call that fragile because look what it built when the ice receded. So to the extent that they have peculiar characteristics that make them react in ways we might not be happy about, then you could apply that term if you wanted. But it's more a matter of understanding how they operate, what they are, and then trying to anticipate what the direct and indirect human actions might have on those processes.
I mean, I guess as we're charged as being your agency, and we in general are charged with being good stewards of this land, right? We want to understand what the effects are going to be. So I guess that's what I mean. Instead of fragile, are there things about the effects that practices that might be just fine in Montana, we have to really be doing a different way here? I guess
good
that's
point.
What, yeah.
Good point. Conversely, because of the low human population, there are things that we can get away with here that you can't in other places, where the cumulative impact of human activities has had a greater effect, both in area and magnitude. But the context for the research that we've begun out of the experimental forest is that there's this vast experiment that we're treating the Earth to right now, which is the injection of massive amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the resulting warming of the atmosphere. And so one of the underlying questions and the thing that drives our desire to understand how these ecosystems function is to be able to better anticipate how that function will change as things get warmer. And you've already mentioned salmon, and of course salmon are considered to be cold water fish that are vulnerable to warming. So that is a big question.
This brings up an issue to me. We're talking about science and we're talking about climate change and global warming. Is that something that is, do you feel moving forward in the current political environment we have, is something that is going to be talked about as freely?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty there, and I don't know. We'll wait. We'll see. We'll see how things go.
All right.
You know, our job is to generate the data and interpret the data as best we can. And beyond that, what we do with those data is a matter for other people to decide.
Well, Rick Edwards is going to be doing this talk tonight, two talks. It's a Friday fireside lecture, 6:30 and 8 o'clock. It's out at the beautiful Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center there, part of a Forest Service Visitor Center. And it's all about the experimental forest. Rick, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know a little bit.
One last little note. Instructions from Lori.
Okay.
She said
that when you have instructions from Lori, you got to follow through.
Exactly. She said to be sure to get there a little early. The elevators are being replaced, and so there are no elevators. You're either going to walk up the ramp or the steps. There's a little ice, although there's a lot of gravel down. But just get there a little. Give yourself a few minutes more time if you're a little struggling with getting about.
Sure, always good advice. Get good seats that way, too.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
You want to be in the front.
You want to be in the front. See all the great work that Rick's been doing. Rick Edwards, thanks so much for coming in.
All right, thank you.
Coming up next, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Black pole warblers breeding in western Alaska make the longest migration of any North American songbird, an annual round trip of 11 to 12,000 miles. In August, the warblers head east on an ancient migratory pathway across the boreal forests of Canada to the Maritime Provinces and the coast of New England. In his book Living on the Wind, author Scott Weidensall describes what happens next. It appears that many black poles strike out south over the ocean, departing at dusk, picking a night with a brisk northerly tailwind. They will need the help. For the next 40 or 50 hours, the tiny songbirds will fly over the western Atlantic, wings buzzing at 20 flaps a second, climbing to altitudes of more than 5,000 feet. They'll show up on weather radar as they pass Bermuda and the Greater Antilles, glowing green specks like ghosts beneath the moon. The warblers follow a curving track, steered and abetted by the wind. At first, the northwesterlies carry them out to sea. Midway, somewhere around Bermuda, the migrants come under the influence of the trade winds. The tiny birds are shepherded back, toward South America, finally making landfall along the coast of Venezuela or Guyana, an overwater trip of about 2,000 miles. A passage with no rest, no refueling, no water, during which each will have flapped its wings nearly 3 million times. Find us at birdnote.org.
Support comes from GCI Wireless with coverage in 200 communities throughout Alaska. More details on available plans and devices at gci.com.
Sarah Schaefer's here to talk about the Seafood Fest. Sarah, And you came in and you said, well, I'm not sure what I can talk about because it's sold out.
Right. I mean, which is great, right?
Which is great.
It's a great problem to have. We sold out already on Wednesday. And the beer tasting that you are so generously hosting, Alaska Brewing Company.
Myself and Sean McLaughlin will be there hosting it and
so
kind of doing a tutored beer tasting, as we always have done with the Seafood Fest. It's one of the highlights of our year there at the brewery. We love doing this event.
Yeah, and you know what? It's like that sold out, I think, already last week. We had 100 tickets, and they went pretty fast. So, yeah, I mean, of course, there's stuff to talk about, right? I could get people excited about the menu because that hasn't been published yet, and, you know, we have...
I think we should be... Here's my proposal.
Tell me.
The Seafood Fest sold out because it's awesome.
It's
awesome because of all the partners that are going to work with. So let's give a shout out to all the partners. Let's talk about the menu for all the people who got in line early enough and got their tickets.
Exactly.
To get them excited. And for those of you that didn't happen to get tickets this year, you know what? This is a good reminder to make sure when this happens next year to get them early.
Absolutely, because we will not be selling tickets at the door. It's just, and I did say, like, for some people that called me, can I still get a ticket? I said, if we get some returns, which hasn't happened yet.
I don't think, yeah.
Yeah, no returns. So, yes, we have 8 great participating restaurants. We've got Breeze Inn, The Rookery, Saffron Salt, Coconut Thai Cafe, TK Maguire's, V Salador, and Twilight Cafe. And they will do halibut, rockfish, and what am I missing? Salmon dishes.
Yeah.
And there are some, of course, there's ceviche, which is, everyone loves, right?
I love it.
There's salmon chorizo. There is some Filipino dishes. Like coconut rockfish with squash, sweet and sour rockfish. There's going to be halibut curry with rice.
Mm.
I mean, I think it's going to be also very international. And this is really, this has really evolved to a kind of a culinary showcase event for Juno.
It's kind of fun to think about the history of this event because it used to be called the Halibut Feed. Back in the old days, it was called the Halibut Feed. And it was done even before there were IFQs for halibut. So there was this one big halibut fishery that happened, and then all this fresh halibut was flooded out on the market, and K2 would get a donation of some of that. And so
right.
We did this halibut feed, and everyone volunteered, all staff together. Then it turned into the Seafood Fest, but it was still all station volunteers would get together, and we'd do this certain stuff, and it was fun. It was a kind of community event.
You would cook, right?
We'd cook it, and we'd barbecue it, and we'd set a certain stuff. But at one point, we kind of, and this is when I was with K2 still, working there, but we thought, boy, you know, there's all this great salmon that we get as this amazing contribution, and it's, remind me again of who.
It's Taku Fisheries.
Taku Fisheries
is
incredible.
Makes
this all happen and makes it all possible.
Absolutely.
And we thought, you know, maybe we need to optimize this gift by having actual chefs.
Yeah, I'm not chopping.
Right?
I'm not. I do a lot with this event, but I'm not chopping vegetables
or standing
at the grill.
That's what we used to do: is chop, be peeling potatoes for the potato salad and all that stuff. It was fun, but I think that it's just grown into such a kind of like command performance sort of event now because. You have the best chefs in Juneau taking the best ingredients and making amazing stuff, and they're able to just showcase one little fun dish. And I think they have fun doing it too, although it's definitely a hectic day.
It is.
For everyone.
And
yeah.
You know what? It's so generous that they give us their time. We have added desserts, right? Copa is going to be there, Glacial Grinds is going to be there, and Heritage Coffee that will do desserts. And Breeze Inn is also featuring some salads for sides. So, it's, of course, seafood is the star, but then for everyone that has a sweet tooth like I do, there's no dinner without dessert. There has to be dessert. So I'm really happy that we have all these great partners. We also have some sponsors this year. It's Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute is sponsoring, which is really generous and lovely. And also Pacific Seafood Processors Association, which are also sponsoring this event to make it possible. And I think we're going to grow this event. I really think so. We're looking forward to it. It's a fun event to organize, and I cannot wait to taste all these good dishes.
Well, it's really fun that I've had fun doing before is going, and then you kind of get ideas for even stuff you can do at home.
Yes.
You know, so you can pick the brain of the chefs that are there and say, well, how'd you do that ceviche, or how'd you do this or that, you know, or think about the idea of thinking about squash in a coconut milk soup kind of,
right?
You know, like that's a really interesting, cool idea.
I know.
Okay, that's something.
I don't
know
if I would attempt the chorizo, though.
Then, okay, yeah.
Would you?
No, well, I don't even, no.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
I wouldn't.
The
rookery
is
going to
feature that tomorrow, so I'm excited to taste that. I would not attempt it though.
Now I saw that Copa was going down to Seattle to Festival of Seafood, and they were going to do some candied salmon ice cream. Did you hear about this?
I have a call out to him today. I don't know what the tastes are going to be yet.
Okay.
So that is going to be the big mystery. I haven't finalized my menu for the dessert yet. So
okay.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned for dessert menu.
There's going to be the surprise.
The reveal.
What ice cream flavors we're going to have, yes. Which is great, right?
Well, yeah, it's awesome. So maybe just with one more time, just run through the different people that are participating and the sponsors that made it possible. And just thank them again for
Absolutely.
Making it possible. Yeah.
So it's, of course, Taco Fisheries that generously donates all that fish to the restaurants, which is just so wonderful. They've been a great partner in this for many, many years. We've got the participating restaurants, Breeze Inn, that also is providing the sides, and then the Rookery, Saffron, Salt, Coconut Thai Cafe, TK McGuire's, V-Seller's Door, and Twilight Cafe, and then Desserts by Copa, Glacial Grinds, and Heritage Coffee. Of course, thank you for Alaskan Brewery for the tuned beer tasting, Seafood Processors Association, Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and ADME, Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, for their generous sponsorship. And I think that's it.
That's kind of it. Well,
yep.
Sarah, thanks so much for coming in, letting us know about it. For those of you who got tickets to this, good on you. Way to go. It's going to be delicious. And if you didn't get it this year, you got to wait for next year. But you know what you're missing here. And make sure you get them early next year as the event continues to grow.
And, of course, I haven't mentioned the auction yet, right?
Oh,
my goodness. Yes, we have a Stella auction. We're trying to elevate that. And we have so many wonderful donations from, like, through tourism, a lot of retail. People have really come out and been very, very generous. So, yes, that's also going to be a surprise.
That's
but
always a fun thing to do at these events, right? You go through,
you know,
look
what?
At the stuff.
If you want to already check out the auction catalog, it is online for everyone to see. And, everyone that is going to be at the event can, of course, bid on the items. The
Very
online
cool.
part is closed for now. So there's no more bidding online, but there is going to be bidding tomorrow, I hope.
Okay, very good. Sarah Schaefer, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about tomorrow's Seafood Festival. It's sold out. Sorry, everyone. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Okay.
The gold in your mountains ain't worth the silver of the sea. The silver of the salmon and all that they bring to me.
And as these kings swim through these streams, passing all death in its eyes, he lives long, he dies young.
Well, thanks for listening to Juno Afternoon today. Where the forecast for tonight is rain. Might be heavy at times with lows around 40 degrees. And for tomorrow, again, rain in the forecast, highs in the mid-40s. Numerous rain showers for tomorrow night. And then scattered snow showers coming up for Sunday. Mostly cloudy skies are predicted for Sunday night. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend. I'm Andy Klein, and that's Juno Afternoon. This song, by the way, is Juno's own Wool Pullers with Silver Salmon.
They dig that hole, they'll blow it all away.
'Cause this mine is not a pebble, it's a giant rolling stone. One that's going to crush us.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Huna, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO.